The BBC presents The Sign of Four, a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio in 5 episodes by Felix Felton. The story is told by Sherlock Holmes' friend and assistant, Dr. Watson. Episode 4, The Quest and the Kill.
Good day to you. It was between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning when Holmes and I returned from our night-long search for the wooden-legged man and his unknown companion. Guided by the mongrel dog Toby, we had followed the trail as far as the edge of the river, and there had learned that he had hired a steam launch from a Mr. Mordecai Smith and escaped us onto the crowded Thames. I was limp and weary after the successive excitements of the night, but a bath at Baker Street and a complete change soon improved matters. When I came down to our room, I found the breakfast laid and Holmes deep in a morning newspaper.
Ah, there you are, Doctor. How are you feeling?
Not too bad, thank you. Anything in the paper?
Everything. The energetic Jones and the ubiquitous reporter have fixed it up between them. It's really rather rich.
Jones hasn't minimized his own contribution, I take it.
Far from it. Help yourself to the ham and eggs. I'll read you some of the finer passages.
Thank you.
Here we are. Mysterious business at Upper Norwood. About 12 o'clock last night, Mr. Bartholomew Sholto of Pondicherry Lodge, Upper Norwood, was found dead in his room under circumstances which point to foul play. As far as we can learn, no traces of violence were found upon Mr. Sholto's person, but a valuable collection of Indian gems inherited from his father has been carried off. The discovery was first made by Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
Oh, we do get a mention then.
Just, but listen to this. By a singular piece of good fortune, Mr. Athelney Jones, a well-known member of the detective police force, was at the Norwood police station at the time and was able to apply his trained and experienced faculties to the case within half an hour of the first alarm.
Oh, really?
And then he goes on to describe his arrest of the housekeeper, the gatekeeper, and the Indian servant.
I still marvel that he didn't arrest us as well.
So do I. He still may if he gets another of those attacks of energy. Now, where was I? Mr. Jones' well-known technical knowledge and his powers of minute observation have enabled him to prove conclusively that the miscreants must have entered through a trap door in the roof.
Well, I'll be...
The prompt and energetic action of the officers of the law shows the great advantage of the presence on such occasions of a single, vigorous and masterful mind.
Holmes, you're positively putting me off my breakfast.
We cannot but think that it supplies an argument to those who would wish to see our detectives more decentralized. Hello, who's this? Ah, splendid. Master Wiggins has received my telegram. Just outside our front door, Watson, there are at least a dozen ragged little street Arabs. The Baker Street irregulars are on parade.
What do you want? You come to upstairs.
Mr. Ramsey expecting me. Sent me a telegram.
All right, only you then. Your friends will have to wait down here.
And there's their leader running the gauntlet of Mrs. Hudson.
Yes, I'm afraid she has met her match. Come in. Ah, Wiggins.
Got your message, sir. Brought mine sharp.
Well done.
They're outside, Gov. The old woman wouldn't let them come up.
Never mind. You can pass on my instructions to your friends. Better than having the house invaded. What's the bill so far?
£3 and a tenner for tickets.
Oh, here you are, then.
Thank you, sir.
Now then, listen carefully.
Yes, sir?
I want you to find the whereabouts of a steamship called the Aurora, owner Mordecai Smith.
Aurora? What's she like, sir?
Black with two red lines. Funnel white with a black band. She's down the river somewhere. I want one boy to be at Mordecai Smith's landing stage to say if the boat comes back.
Yes, sir.
Divide it out among yourselves and do both banks thoroughly and let me know the moment you have news. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
The old scale of pay and a guinea to the boy who finds the boat. Here's a day in advance.
Thank you, sir.
Now, off you go.
Thank you, Gov. We'll find it for you.
Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
That should do it, Watson. I'll wager we hear they've spotted her before evening. There they go, hell for leather. They'll worm their way in everywhere without attracting the least attention.
What do we do while they're searching?
Wait, there's nothing else we can do. We can't pick up the broken trail until we find either the Aurora or Mordecai Smith.
Well, Toby could eat these scraps, I dare say. Well, are you going to bed, Holmes?
No, I'm not tired. I have a curious constitution. I never remember feeling tired by work, but idleness exhausts me completely. I'm going to smoke and think over this queer business to which our fair client has introduced us. If ever man had an easy task, this should be it. Wooden-legged men are not so common, but the other man should be quite unique.
Ah, that other man again.
I don't want to make a mystery of him, Watson, but you must have formed your own opinion.
I can't say I have.
Consider the data. Diminutive footmarks, naked feet, toes never fettered by boots, great agility. Stone-headed wooden mace, poisoned darts. What do you make of it?
Must be a savage. Perhaps one of those Indians that Jonathan Small was in league with.
Hardly that. No one in the Indian Peninsula could have left footmarks like that. The Hindu proper has long, thin feet. The Mohammedan wears sandals, which means that the great toe is well separated from the others because of the thong that passes in between. What about these darts? They could only be shot in one way.
From a blowpipe.
Exactly. So where are we to find our savage?
I don't know. South America.
Hand me the first volume of the Gazetteer.
Here you are.
Thank you. Now, what have we here? Andaman Islands. Situated 340 miles to the north of Sumatra in the Bay of Bengal.
That's where Sholto was stationed.
Exactly. Now, what can we learn about them? Here we are. The aborigines of the Andaman Islands may perhaps claim the distinction of being the smallest race on Earth. The average height is rather below 4 feet. They are fierce and intractable, but capable of forming devoted friendships. You see, Watson?
I do indeed.
Now then, listen to this. They are naturally hideous, having large, misshapen heads and distorted features, but their hands and feet are remarkably small.
That fits all right.
So does this. They have always been a terror to shipwrecked crews, braining the survivors with their stone-headed clubs or shooting them with their poisoned arrows.
Nice, amiable people.
You're right. If this fellow had been left to his own devices, the affair might have taken an even more ghastly turn.
But how on earth did Jonathan Small come to have such a singular companion?
That's more than I can tell. No doubt we shall know all about it in time. Look here, Watson, you still look as if you could do with a rest. Lie down there on the sofa and see if I can put you to sleep.
As I stretched myself out, Holmes took his violin from the corner and began to play some low, dreamy, melodious air. I have a vague remembrance of his gaunt limbs, his earnest face, and the rise and fall of his bow. And then I seem to float peacefully away on a sea of sound, with the sweet face of Mary Morstan looking down at me. It was late afternoon when I awoke. Holmes sat exactly as I had left him, except that he had laid aside his violin and was deep in a book. I noticed that his face was dark and troubled.
How do you feel?
Oh, much better, thank you.
You slept soundly. I feared our talk would disturb you.
I didn't hear a thing. You've had fresh news, then?
Unfortunately, no. I must confess I'm very disappointed. I expected something definite by this time. The boy Wiggins has been up. He says no trace can be found of the lounge anywhere. It's the most provoking check. Every hour is of importance.
Can I do anything? I'm feeling perfectly fresh now.
No, we can only wait. If we go ourselves, the message might come in our absence. You do what you like, but I must remain on guard.
Then I'll run over to Camberwell and call on Mrs. Cecil Forrester. I was asked to this morning.
On Mrs. Forrester?
Well, of course on Miss Morstan, too. She was anxious to hear what happened.
I shouldn't tell them too much. Women are never to be entirely trusted, even the best of them.
Holmes, what an atrocious sentiment. Very well, I'll be discreet. I should be back in an hour or two.
All right. Good luck. But I say...
Yes?
If you're crossing the water, you may as well return Toby. I don't think we shall have any more use for him now.
I took the mongrel and left him with a half-sovereign at the old naturalist's in Pinchin Lane. Then I went on to Miss Morstan, whom I found weary after her night's adventures, but very eager to hear my news. Mrs. Forrester, too, was full of curiosity. I told them all we had done since the previous night. It was evening before I left Camberwell, and quite dark by the time I reached home. My companion's book and pipe lay by his chair, but he had disappeared. I looked about in the hope of seeing a note but there wasn't one.
Oh, excuse me, sir. Can I lower the blinds?
Well, certainly, Mrs. Hudson. I suppose Mr. Holmes has gone out.
Oh, no, sir. He's gone to his room, sir.
Oh?
Do you know, sir, I'm afraid for his health.
Why do you say that?
Well, he's that strange, sir. After he was gone, he kept on walking up and down till he got on my nerves. Then I heard him talking to himself. And every time the doorbell went, he'd come onto the landing and shouted, "What's that, Mrs. Hudson?" Then he slammed off to his room again. Oh, I do hope he's not going to be ill, sir.
I don't think you need be uneasy, Mrs. Hudson. I've seen him like this before. He's got something on his mind.
Well, I hope that's all it is, sir, I'm sure.
From time to time during the long night, I heard the dull sound of Holmes' tread and knew how his spirit was chafing against our inaction. At breakfast time, he appeared looking worn and haggard, with a little fleck of feverish colour on either cheek.
I simply cannot understand it, Watson.
You're knocking yourself up, old man. I heard you marching about in the night.
I couldn't sleep. This infernal problem is consuming me. I know the men, the launch, everything. The whole river's been searched on either side. I've used every means at my disposal, and yet I can get no news.
Mrs. Smith heard nothing of her husband?
No. I shall come to the conclusion soon that they've scuttled the craft. But why?
Perhaps Mrs. Smith was deceiving us. Perhaps the Aurora is sheer invention.
No, I've made inquiries. There is a launch of that description.
Could it have gone upriver?
I've thought of that, too. There's a search party working up as far as Richmond. If no news comes today, I shall start looking myself. Oh, but surely we shall hear something.
However, no word came from the boy Wiggins or anyone else all that day. I walked over to Camberwell in the evening to report our ill success to the ladies, and returned to find Holmes busy with some abstruse chemical analysis, whose smell fairly drove me out of the apartment. I could hear the clinking of his malodorous test tubes till the small hours of the morning. In the early dawn, I woke with a start. Holmes was standing by my bedside, fully dressed.
I'm off down the river, Watson.
Hmm?
It's the only thing to do. It's worth trying at all events.
Can't I come with you?
No, you'll be much more useful if you stay here. Open all notes and telegrams, and if any news does come, act on your own judgment. Can I rely on you?
Of course. Can I get in touch with you by wire?
I'm afraid not. I don't know where I shall be myself. With any luck, though, I may not be gone very long. Oh, by the way, you may get callers.
Oh?
Yes. I've put an advertisement in this morning's Agony column asking anyone who knows the whereabouts of the Aurora to get in touch with Mrs. Smith of Smith's Wharf or with 221B Baker Street. That makes it look as if it's merely Mrs. Smith showing anxiety for her missing husband.
Hmm, that's very ingenious.
Hold the fort, then. I'll have some news of some sort or other before I get back. Au revoir.
I had heard nothing of him by breakfast time. The morning paper carrying his notice also informed me that Mr. Thaddeus Sholto and Mrs. Burnstone had now been released, but that Mr. Athelney Jones of Scotland Yard was prosecuting the case with his usual energy and sagacity, and that further arrests were to be expected. The long day dragged on, until at 3 o'clock in the afternoon there was a loud peal at the bell and voices on the stairs.
Come back?
No, sir, he's been out all day.
Oh, I'll see Dr. Watson then.
Very good, sir.
Come in.
Mr. Athelney Jones to see you, sir.
Ah, come in, Mr. Jones.
Good day, sir. Mr. Sherlock Holmes is out, I understand.
Yes, and I'm afraid I don't know when he'll be back. Well, perhaps you'd care to wait. Take that chair and try one of these cigars.
Oh, thank you. I don't mind if I do.
And whiskey and soda?
Oh, well, half a glass. It's very warm for the time of year, and I've had a good deal to try me. You know my theory about this Norwood case?
I remember you expressed one.
Well, I've been obliged to reconsider it.
Oh?
Yes. I'd got my net nice and tight round Mr. Sholto when Poppy went through a hole in the middle of it.
I saw you'd released him.
Yes, I can't shake his alibi. Someone was with him all the time from the moment he left his brother's room. My professional credit's at stake, sir. I should be very glad of a little assistance.
Well, we can all do with it at times.
I had a wire from Mr. Holmes this morning. He's a wonderful man, is Mr. Holmes.
Well, what did the wire say?
Here it is, sir. Handed in at Poplar at 12 o'clock. Go to Baker Street and wait for me. I'm close on track of Sholto gang. Come tonight if you want to be in it, finish.
Ah, splendid. He's evidently picked up the scent again.
Oh, so he's been at fault too, has he? Well, happens to the best of us. Of course, it may be only a false alarm, but as an officer of the law, I mustn't let any chance slip. Oh, hello, who's this?
I'll have a look. It's an old seaman of sorts. He's seen Holmes' advertisement in the paper, no doubt. And has something to tell us.
What advertisement was that?
About the steam launch, Aurora. We think the men you're after may be aboard it. This fellow may have some news of her.
Let's hope so.
Come in.
Someone for Mr. Holmes.
All right. Come in, my man. Thank you, Mrs. Hudson. Our visitor was an aged man, clad in seafaring garb with an old pea jacket and a red scarf around his chin. His back was bent and he wheezed painfully as he stood leaning heavily on a thick, knotted stick. Bushy eyebrows and long gray side whiskers concealed most of his face, except a pair of keen, dark eyes. But altogether, he gave the impression of a respectable master mariner who had fallen into years and poverty.
Is Mr. Sherlock Holmes here?
No, but I am acting for him. You can give me any message you have for him.
It was to him I wish to tell it.
I tell you, I am acting for him. Was it about the Aurora?
Yes, I knows where it is. And I know where the men he's after are. I knows all about it. But it was to Mr. Holmes I was to tell it.
Well, you'll have to wait for him then.
I know. No, I ain't going to lose a whole day to please no one. If Mr. Holmes ain't here, then he can find out for himself. I don't care about the looks of either of you, and that's the truth. I'm going home.
Now, wait a bit, my friend. You're not walking off like that. You'll stay here, like it or not, till our friend returns.
That's a pretty start of treatment, this. I come here to see a gentleman, and you two...
You'll be none the worse. We'll recompense you for your loss of time.
Oh, then perhaps you'll begin by offering me a cigar.
Oh, sister?
Oh, well, I might.
Well, I hardly thought I'd pass that test.
Why, you rogue. Oh, you'd have made a rare actor, you would. Proper workhouse cough, too, and everything. Oh, but I thought you had a glint in your eye, though.
Well, I've been working in that get-up all day. Too many of the criminal classes know me. I can only go on the warpath under some simple disguise like this.
Have you got my wire?
Yes, that's why I'm here.
How's your case going?
It's collapsed. I've had to release Sholto and the housekeeper.
Never mind. I'll give you two people in their place. But you must put yourself under my orders. You're welcome to all the official credit, but you must do as I say. Is that agreed?
Entirely.
Then I shall want a fast police boat, a steam launch, to be at Westminster Stairs at 7 o'clock.
That's easy enough. There's always one around about there. But I can slip across the road and telephone to make sure.
I shall also want two staunch men in case of resistance.
There'll be two or three in the boat. Anything else?
When we secure the men, we shall get the treasure. I think it would be a pleasure to my friend here to take the box round to the young lady to whom half of it rightly belongs. Let her be the first to open it. Eh, Watson?
It would certainly be a great pleasure to me.
Well, that's rather irregular, but still, so is the whole thing, so I suppose we must wink at it. The treasure will have to be handed over afterwards to the authorities until there's been an official investigation.
Oh, certainly. Oh, one other point. I should very much like to have a few details on this matter from Johnson Small myself. I take it you don't mind my having an unofficial interview with him here or elsewhere, as long as he's efficiently guarded.
Well, you're a master of the situation. I've no proof yet that this man exists. But if you catch him, you can interview him.
That's understood, then?
Perfectly. Anything else?
Only that I insist on your dining with us here.
Oh, thank you.
I have oysters and a brace of grouse with something a little choice in white wines. Watson, you have never yet recognized my merits as a housekeeper.
Our meal was a merry one. Holmes appeared to be in a state of nervous exaltation. I've never known him so brilliant. He spoke on medieval pottery, on Stradivarius violins, on the Buddhism of Ceylon, and the warships of the future, as if he had made a special study of each. Then, with a bumper to the success of our expedition, we set out. I, with my old service revolver in my pocket. At Westminster Wharf, the police launch was awaiting us. Jones, Holmes, and I sat in the stern. There was one man at the rudder, one to tend the engines, and two burly police inspectors forward.
Is there anything to mark this as a police boat?
Yes, that green lamp at the side.
Take it off, then.
Take the lamp off, Inspector.
Yes, sir.
Where to, Mr. Holmes?
To the tower. Tell them to stop opposite Jacobson's yard.
Down river. Right away.
Very good, sir.
I hope she's fast.
There aren't many launches on the river to meet us.
The one we're after is said to be quite a clipper. Now, Watson, I'll tell you how the land lies. You know how I gave my mind a thorough rest by plunging into a chemical analysis?
I do indeed.
Well, when I had dissolved the hydrocarbon, I came back to the case and thought the whole matter out again. And it seemed to me unlikely that Jonathan Small would aim to get away at once.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, he'd clearly been in London for some time, keeping watch. So he'd have to arrange his affairs before he went.
Oh, I don't know. He might have done it already.
I hardly think so. The finding of the treasure must have come as a complete surprise. And then there's the peculiar-looking companion. He'd scarcely want to be seen around with him in the daylight. And we know from Mrs. Smith that it was getting on for dawn when they hired the boat. So I argued that they may well have reserved the boat for their final escape and gone to ground in their lodgings for a day or two to see what the papers had to say.
Taking the launch with them.
That's the point. If I was right, the launch must be hidden somewhere nearby.
Yes, where? They can't have made it invisible.
I put myself in Small's place. How could he hide the launch and yet have her ready to hand? I see one way of doing it. By handing her over to some boat builder for some trifling repair. Then she'd be concealed in his shed or yard.
That seems simple enough.
Oh, it's just these simple things that are apt to be overlooked. I acted on the idea and went in my seaman's rig to all the yards down the river. I drew blank at 15, but at the 16th, Jacobson's, there she was.
Well done, Holmes.
Yes, she was handed over to them 2 days ago by a wooden-legged man who said there was something wrong with her rudder.
My dear Holmes, I do apologize for ever...
That wasn't the end of it. Who should appear but Mordecai Smith, the missing owner, rather the worse for liquor. He bellowed out his name and the name of his launch, and then he said, I want her tonight at 8 o'clock sharp. I have two gentlemen who won't be kept waiting. We must see that we don't keep them waiting either.
While we were talking, we had been shooting the long series of bridges that span the Thames. Nearing the city, the rising moon silvered the cross on the summit of St. Paul's. As we reached the tower, Holmes pointed to a bristle of masts and rigging on the Surrey side.
That's Jacobson's yard. Cruise gently up and down here under cover of this string of lighters.
What are you about, John? Let's go.
There's my sentry at his post.
Oh, you've placed a man there, have you?
A boy, one of my Baker Street irregulars. There he is at the water's edge. Here, take my night glasses. You can see for yourself.
Oh, thank you.
He will wave a handkerchief when they start. No sign yet?
Why don't we go downstream and lie in wait for them?
No, there's just the chance they might go upstream. We're better where we are. From this point, we can see everything perfectly and hardly be observed ourselves. Those folk yonder, see? How clearly are they visible under the lamplight?
They're coming from work in the yard.
Dirty-looking rascals. But I suppose everyone has some little immortal spark concealed about him. A strange enigma is man.
Didn't somebody call him a soul concealed in an animal?
Winwood Reed is good on the subject. He remarks that while the individual man is an insoluble puzzle, in the aggregate he becomes a mathematical...
Mr. Holmes! There's a handkerchief!
Yes, it's your boy! I can see him plainly.
And there's the Aurora. Going like the devil, too. Full speed ahead, engineer.
All right, sir.
Make after the launch for the yellow light. By heaven, I'll never forgive myself if she has the heels of us.
She's very fast. I doubt if we should catch her.
We must catch her. Keep it on, stokers. Make her do all she can. Even if we burn the boat, we must have...
With every throb of the engines, we sprang forward like a living thing. We flashed past barges, steamers, and merchant vessels. Voices hailed us out of the darkness. Once a tug, with three barges in tow, blundered in between us.
Where do you think you're going?
Still, we followed close on the Aurora's track.
Pile it on, men. Pile it on. Get every pound of steam you can.
I think we gain a little.
I'm sure of it. We'll be up with her in a very few minutes.
Turn your searchlight on her.
We are gaining.
They're small, sitting in the stern. They know we're after them now.
What's that dark mass lying beside him like a Newfoundland dog?
Ah, there's the danger. Shoot if it moves.
Look at Small. He's after something. You see what he's doing, Holmes?
Never mind him. Watch that bundle at his feet.
I'll hail them.
Hey, stop there! Stop!
It's the white promise here! Go to the devil!
That's him, all right. Look at the wooden stump.
Watch that bundle.
It's a man. A miniature man. The smallest and most savage I have ever seen.
And armed with a blowpipe. We must take no chances. Fire if he raises his head.
It was well that we had so clear a view. Even as we looked, the pygmy plucked out from under the dark blanket in which he was wrapped a short, round piece of wood, like a school ruler, and clapped it to his lips. Our pistols rang out together.
Mr. Holmes, your order. The wooden-legged man's got the rudder. He's steering into the bank.
Let him.
But he'll leap ashore.
Onto the mud with that wooden leg. He's a fool if he does.
Ah! By heavens, he's done it. He's trapped. Trapped in the mud.
There you are, Jones. There's your Mr. Jonathan Small.
Throw the poor devil a rope and haul him aboard.
Aye, aye, sir.
That was the end of our chase. Jonathan Small was dragged over the side like some evil fish. The two Smiths, father and son, aboard me, were herself made fast to our stern. Solid iron chest of Indian workmanship's deck. There was no key, but it was of considerable weight when we transferred it carefully to our own little cabin. Then we steamed slowly upstream again, flashing our searchlight on either side of us.
No sign of the islander. Down there, he'll remain that strange visitor to our shores, somewhere in the Thames dark ooze. An interesting type. I'd like to have seen him at closer quarters.
Personally, I'm glad I didn't. Well, Holmes, another case solved.
Not yet, Watson. Settled, you might say, but not solved. Watson.
Yes, Holmes?
Look there, in the wood of the hatchway. That's where we were standing when the chase was on, do you see?
Another of those murderous darts.
Yes. We were hardly quick enough when we fired. A horrible death passed us very close tonight.
Upon my soul, Holmes, you treat it very lightly.
Well, why not? When death passes you by, you realize that life is worth living. To me, that poison thorn is the stimulant that consumes me with curiosity. Watson, you called this another case solved. You're wrong, you know. We've the treasure and the men, or one of them. But what makes a man do these things? What is the power or the curse behind that ill-omened box? That's what we'll learn when we hear the story of Jonathan Small.
That was The Sign of Four, the fourth of five episodes of a Sherlock Holmes story by Sir Arthur Conan, with Richard Herndl as Holmes and Brian Coleman as Dr. Watson. Radio adaptation by Felix Felton. Production for the BBC by Archie Campbell.